Oh, I want to say hi to Raj Maskey. He's one of my former community health graduates working in the state of Alaska.
Thank you. Is this my copy? Thank you. Okay. Well, our last speaker is Susan, is it Suzanne or Susan? Susan Schmall? Okay. She is at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, which is gorgeous if you've never been there, in the Center of Excellence for Training and Research Translation. Suzanne? Okay. It's Susan or Suzanne?
Suzanne.
Okay, I'm sorry. It's still early for me for some reason. Suzanne has worked in chronic disease prevention, primarily obesity prevention, for over 6 years, and is training for her second half marathon. Congratulations. So, okay.
Thank you for the introduction. I am Suzanne. I am with the Center for Health Promotion and Disease Prevention, and I may be in the minority here today. I'm not a nurse, but I am at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and I'm going to share a little bit today about our research translation process. And I have no relationships to disclose as well. I work as part of a project team with the Center of Excellence for Training and Research Translation, which I'll refer to as Center TRT. The CDC funded the Center TRT to work with the Division for Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention's Wise Woman program, which provides under and uninsured women ages 40 to 64 with skills and knowledge to prevent and control cardiovascular disease. We are also funded by the Division for Nutrition and Physical Activity and Obesity to work with the obesity prevention programs, and they're currently in 23 funded program states. The Center TRT has two primary functions. One of those is training, and training public health practitioners through in-service educational opportunities as well as web-based modules. And Kelly Norby, one of our project team members, is here today as well, and she's going to be presenting on the web-based modules this afternoon at 4:30 in room 11A if you are interested in learning more about the web-based modules. But I'm here to talk with you a little bit more about our other primary function, which is research translation, which is essentially just identifying those effective interventions and programs that have been found to be effective and communicating those in a meaningful way to public health practitioners. And you may have heard of From the Bench to the Bedside for clinical practice. You can kind of think of for public health research translation as from the bookshelf to the community. So this is our translation framework. As you can see, it is a four-phase model. And the first phase is evidence identification and review, which includes contributing factors, intervention strategies, as well as interventions. The second phase is intervention abstraction, which is essentially where we collaborate with the intervention developers and identify the information that's essential for implementing that intervention and developing what we call an intervention template, which I'll talk about a little bit more in a second. The third phase is dissemination, which is just getting that information out to practitioners. And then we have a feedback loop where not only research is informing practice, but practice is informing research as well. I mentioned that the first phase is the evidence identification and review, and that includes the contributing factors or risk factors as well as intervention strategies, but it also includes interventions. We have a national advisory board that's guided our work, and they advise us to not only include research-tested interventions, but to include practice-based interventions as well. And you can see here that the research-tested interventions are those that are tested and published in the peer-reviewed literature, and practice-based interventions are those that are developed and evaluated in the field. So we developed a review criteria for these interventions, and you can see from this list that they're essentially the same for both practice-based and the research-tested interventions. However, I'll point out a couple of differences. For the research-tested interventions, the methodology used to test the intervention is what is reviewed, and this includes sampling methodology, measurement, data analysis, and interpretation of results, whereas with the practice-based interventions, that includes more like formative work, documentation of process evaluation, evidence-supported interventions. And while we do ask for outcomes, evaluation outcomes, they're not as heavily emphasized with the practice-based interventions as they are with the research-tested interventions. So that's the review criteria, but then what's the actual process for the review? So we work with the CDC, and they help with the selection of the interventions, again, and that's for both the Wise Woman and the obesity prevention programs. And then the intervention developers are invited to submit an application to the center TRT, and a staff person or staff liaison is assigned to them to work with them throughout this process and guide them through the process, and if they have address any questions that they may have. And once we receive all the materials, we assemble them in a package and give those to an expert review panel, which includes at least two independent reviewers who then assess these interventions to see if they're ready for translation dissemination. And if they are recommended for dissemination, then the staff person, that same assigned staff person, continues to collaborate and work with the staff, the intervention developers, as well as the CDC, to develop the intervention template, collect their intervention materials, and disseminate those in a meaningful way. It's a very collaborative process. The intervention developers are obviously involved throughout the entire process. They're obviously the ones that are the experts on their intervention. I keep referring to the intervention template, and there is an actual document, but it's also a web-based. There's a web-based version, due to time today, I'm not going to be able to go through all of the components to this, but we worked a lot with our two primary user groups who gave us a lot of feedback about what was essential, what they considered to be essential for implementing these interventions, and that included an overview, what was identified as core elements, and these are really those core components that are viewed as the effectiveness for the intervention. There are intervention materials as well as training and technical assistance information and other information. Again, you can go to our website and see a little bit more about what the intervention template is. Then again, the third phase for the translation model, as you'll recall, is the dissemination, and we do that through passive dissemination through our website, which is www.center-trt.org. If you haven't seen that, we definitely encourage you to check that out. We also disseminate evidence through our active dissemination through our in-person trainings as well as our web-based modules. And what we see as a strength of our model is the link between translation and training. We not only provide the what to do, which includes the evidence-based strategies and the interventions, but the how to do it, which might include toolkits as well as training on how to implement that intervention. And an intervention that nicely represents this model is NAPSAC, which stands for Nutrition and Physical Activity, Self-Assessment, and Child Care. And this is an intervention in the child care setting, which focuses on policy and environmental change regarding healthy eating and physical activity. And this intervention has been reviewed as a practice-based intervention. It's been templated. The intervention materials are posted on the website. There is access on our website as well to web-based training to help public health practitioners learn how to implement this intervention and become consultants for NAPSAC. So as with any process, there are challenges that are identified. There's a limited number of research-tested interventions, but we feel like we've addressed this as the advisory board advised us to include practice-based interventions. There are very few interventions packaged for dissemination. It's difficult to balance the fidelity of implementation, which means implementing the intervention as intended and when adapting it to different contexts. But how we think our center has responded to some of these challenges, again, guided by the National Advisory Board, we define the evidence broadly, which includes not only the evidence from systematic reviews, but also parallel evidence such as tobacco policy as well as expert opinion. So again, just not relying on only those systematic reviews. We disseminate information and resources needed to develop evidence-informed interventions, provide evidence consistent with the community guide, again, not relying only on systematic reviews, review and disseminate, I mentioned this, both research-tested and practice-based interventions, and again, that providing not only that what to do, but the how to do it as far as linking translation with training. For those of you who are in translation work, I apologize for overusing this quote. I know it's been completely overutilized by Larry Green, but if we want more evidence-based practice, we need more practice-based evidence, and Larry is part of our National Advisory Board, and we want to thank our National Advisory Board. Not all of them are present in this picture, but they've been very critical to guiding our process, as well as the CDC and definitely the state-based programs, so we definitely want to thank them. Again, this is our website, www.center-trt.org. We also have some brochures at the back of the room if you're interested, and encourage you to check those out. And if you have any questions or comments or feedback as well, I'll be happy to hear that. And thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you very much. So let me go ahead and open the floor up for questions. I mean, we had just wonderful presentations. Are there any questions for the speakers? Yes.
This one's for Suzanne. How long does it take you to go from one of
the specialists? Oh, I need you to come to them and repeat the question.
Okay, I'm sorry. Okay. The question, I believe, was how long does it take to go through the review? I'm assuming you mean the review process. It varies. It typically takes, we've been piloting the process, so that takes a little bit longer. So we've done several interventions, but once, now that we've kind of worked out some of the kinks, it takes about approximately, I would say, 3 months. It also depends on where the state-based programs are with their packaging of their projects, because they do have to be ready for dissemination. So it just kind of depends on where they're at as well. But probably once they actually start the application process, from start to finish, I'd say it's 2 to 3 months.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
I have a couple questions. One has to do with the underlying problem of the demographics of the United States regarding health workforce. Someone alluded to that. And so even though we've all seen the data that shows that health professions are going to be crying out for people shortly, there's not going to be enough young people in the United States to fill the positions. So there'll be competition with people going into business, people going into engineering, and a variety of things. What is going to be the solution to that underlying problem? It just seems like we cannot compete for an inadequate pool of people.
And I think a corollary to that is right now what we're seeing is a brain drain in other countries. So the Philippines, we're recruiting nurses and nursing with it has its own ethical plus other issues. So
the question was, how do we deal with the demographic challenges that there aren't enough people in the younger cohorts to actually fill the positions that are going to be vacant? And I think really, unfortunately, what the focus of our intervention is that we have to compete for the younger people. I mean, we can either compete more aggressively to try and get more people into healthcare, or we can try to import more workers. I mean, the other possibility is that the actual way in which healthcare is delivered will have to adjust as well. So, you know, we are looking into scope of practice issues of like reconfiguring who does what. Starting to think about technology a little bit differently in terms of what are the personnel resource requirements of the different technologies that we have. You know, I think it's going to be an enormous challenge. And I think what we have come to realize is that we need to anticipate that, in fact, if we don't start to train people now, things are going to be much worse than they otherwise would be. So it wasn't an answer, but I think by anticipating what we need to do, we'll be in a better place.
I want to just speak to nursing. There are so many nursing candidates that are turned away because there aren't enough faculty. So there's really an interest, and we're seeing a shift from people that work in high tech that want to go into nursing and from other fields. So part of it is also looking and making sure there are enough faculty and training programs for the people that do want to shift into it.
Well, actually, you know, I was mulling this over. Why not have an educational system that raises all of our students up to their true potential, and so that we aren't competing with business and engineering, but McDonald's has a shortage of burger flippers. We have an educational system right now that is truly not meeting the needs of our students. We have a lot of bright students who drop out of school. I think we have plenty of people, but our educational system is not adequate. And so these programs are starting to address some of the problems within our school systems. When you've got a 30 to 40% dropout rate, those are not stupid people dropping out. Those are people for whom their potential has not been achieved.
I would actually like to just talk about, I think, the issue, which I think is compensation for effort. So we don't pay our public health workforce enough to make it something that seems appealing to people who have just spent oodles of dollars finishing their education. So what I think a lot of the initiatives are also doing is providing that financial assistance to get people at least through school so they don't leave with $100,000 in debt to where then actually working at the community level would not allow them to pay back their dues. So there's also a House bill that was put forth. It hasn't gone anywhere yet, which is focused on preparedness, but it has a large training program piece where they would support financial support for students that agree to work in the public sector for a certain number of years in exchange for paying tuition and the like. So I think that we need to really reconsider how we compensate our public health workforce, because that, I mean, just from hearing students speak, that is why they don't take the job that will pay them minimal amounts, and they'll go elsewhere. So.
So a follow-up question then. I don't know if you'll find many people who feel that we don't spend enough money on our government, which is oftentimes the source of funding for a lot of our public health workers, or that we don't spend enough money on our healthcare system, which is going to be the source of money for attracting more health workers. So I don't know about the prospect of out-competing for this pool, this shrinking pool of people brought into the health professions. The other issue that was raised, and that was the fundamental problem of not being able to attract health professionals to the educational arena, because practitioners can make more money than health educators, particularly health educators with PhDs. I don't see any examples of dealing with that problem, which is, until that point, we're going to have a long line of people who are qualified to enter programs who can't because of the space limitation.
So then your question is, how do we bring people into the academic arena to train the next? And actually, I think the nursing program, and I sort of had a question related to that as well, if we can tag. You talked about bringing clinical nurses in to train them as faculty. So in the clinical field or in the classroom?
Well, they stay as practitioners in their facility, but they're typically given an adjunct faculty position that is paid either by the university or college or by their institution, because they know they're going to be producing more nurses for where they work. And in terms of faculty, at least Mesa State College on the Western Slope is looking at changing faculty salaries as competitively as their school of business, with funding from some of the institutions around them because of the increased oil industry and increased healthcare. And there's going to be some unique solutions that come not from government but come from communities that look at their own resources and what the needs are and how they can solve it.
And I would like to just respond to the point you made about there isn't more government money that's likely to become available. In Colorado right now, there is an effort to consolidate the loan repayment programs for physicians As it turns out, there are six of them, and they all operate differently with different conditions. And so the idea was, let's just take the resources we have and begin to think about it creatively so that we are at least being efficient about who's getting which money, and the programs aren't competing with one another. And similarly, there are efforts to put all the information about student loans in a convenient place so that basically each student doesn't have to try and filter through the internet to figure out what they qualify for. We've even found that some of the loan or payment programs actually have requirements that prevent people from using them. Our nurse faculty, for example, found that they had to get a Colorado loan, they had to be in a Colorado program, which disenfranchised them from taking advantage of distance learning programs that were actually located in other states. And the other requirement was that they be full-time students. Well, that is a problem for faculty who want to teach and at the same time pursue their advanced degrees. So by taking a look at the current requirements and consolidating some of the loans, the scholarships, and the loan repayment programs, I think we can do a better job with what we have.
Any other questions? Yes, ma'am.
I want to thank the panel for presenting their universities about the exciting event that we have next week when we actually might have some change in healthcare reform. I wanted to ask about not only training but dissemination too. When you talk about the public health workforce and the strategies, does that include the Indian Health Service? And does it also include the VA Veterans Administration system, which
so your question was, are there methods for both researching and disseminating?
Is that relevant to Indian Health Service as well as to the VA system for the students? You know, how do we promote those in dissemination? Do you take into consideration dissemination to practitioners within that Indian Health Service?
So how is promotion and dissemination occurring within regards to the Indian community as well as, the Veterans Administration for Veterans, if at all? I don't know, how large is the Indian population, the Veterans population in North Carolina? Or Indian Health Service, I'm sorry. Because there's North Carolina as well.
Right. I'm probably not going to address your question entirely, but for our population, it's primarily through the CDC. So our primary user groups are the Wise Woman population and the obesity prevention program. So that's our primary target audience.
That's not included for
IHS. Right.
Just to your point, I'm aware that some of the federal agencies and CDC in particular are becoming concerned about recruiting new employees, and certainly that would hold true for the VA and the Indian Health Service. Our particular evaluation really was focused on the needs in Colorado and more in the public sector, but the non-governmental public sector. So we didn't specifically address the Indian Health Service or the VA, but I think some of the same strategies would have to apply in terms of active recruitment of potential candidates, support for training, and partnerships with communities such that then the recruitment becomes a more viable option, especially in areas that are underserved.
Anybody else? I had a question for Carolyn, because you looked at the PQIs, which was avoidable hospitalizations, and I'm assuming that's actual admittance into the hospital. I was wondering if at some point you were going to come back and look at the ER visits, because there's been a scale that's been developed to determine the actual emergency aspect of the ER visit or ED visit.
Well, probably our next steps are not going to include that. What we are probably going to focus on is honing in on those PQIs and PDIs and looking at some of the confounding factors. I think the methodology that we have to work on the process. So I would answer your question with maybe eventually, but probably more likely we're going to hone our methods and look at our data, our counts. We need to hone in and look at where we are counting doctors, because what we have found is that many of the lists that we have for providers, whether it's nurses or doctors, they don't jive. And so we're trying to figure out by working with our licensing board where those doctors are first, and then probably go into the next steps and looking at multiple kinds of data sets. So maybe eventually, but we got to tighten up our process as it is now.
Anybody else? Well, in that case, thank you all very much for coming out so early in the morning. And not much of the conference left, but have a good conference with what's left. So, thank you.
It's really passionate about me.